history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some seemingly ordinary Americans around you with extraordinary stories to tell. Sometimes it's just a matter of taking a little time to ask a few questions and then listening to the amazing things that might follow. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, we sure do learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And I'm going to apologize in advance here today because I know there is no way I can fully capture the adventures of today's guest, 94-year-old Denny Thompson of Sonora, California, a twice-wounded bombardier in World War II. He went on to become a bush pilot in Africa, a famed hunting guide in Alaska, not to mention a commercial fisherman for 65 years in the Bering Sea. And as we're going to hear, he is still incredibly active at age 94. But I want to go back a few years, when he was one of the fighting Thompson brothers back home in Minnesota. One older brother, Leroy, was wounded twice in the Pacific. Another, Vernon, was wounded in Italy. And we're going to hear how Denny received his two Purple Hearts, but that's five Purple Hearts in one family. Denny had caught the flying bug when barnstormers came through the Midwest and he got to go up in the air as a 12-year-old. Less than a decade later, he had enlisted in the Army Air Corps with the dream of becoming a pilot. How did that all work out for you, Denny?
It was exciting, but it was scary at times, too. The first 8 or 10 missions, you know, were the most exciting.
And I should clarify for people listening, you went in to be a pilot, but as so many others, that wasn't what happened. They made you a bombardier.
That's right. I had my choice. It was four different categories to become an officer in there. It was navigator, the bombardier, the pilot, and an observer. A lot of us passed the pilot thing right away, and we were in San Antonio, winning. We waited within 6 or 8 weeks at least. We were getting nervous. We wanted to get in. So then we heard that pilots might be 6 months before you ever got pilot training, but you could go to bombardier or navigator training anytime. And when you got through, then you could go through pilot training as an officer. And so that sounded pretty good. It sounded quicker than going the other way. Mm-hmm. So I went through the bombardier thing and ready to go in for the pilot, and they decided we had to fly our 30 missions over somewhere, and then we could go through the pilot train, which is exactly what happened.
If you could survive 30 missions,
yeah,
which at that point in the war was not a given.
I tell you, those last 15, 20 missions went very, very slow. There was times, I can remember at one time we went 3 missions in a row in 3 days, and each one would be 16 hours or so, because by the time we got up in the morning, woke up, went to pre-briefing as a lead crew, then go to chow, then go to the regular meeting, and then get out to the airplanes and wait for the green light to take off and fly as much as 9 or 10 hours, and get back and then be briefed, because we were the lead crew, all 30 missions, briefed on the mission. And then by the time we got to bed, it was 16, 17 hours at least. Mm-hmm. But I remember 3 days in a row we'd done that in the bad targets, Berlin and over in there. I know the third one, I didn't give a damn if I got shot or not.
You were just so
I
exhausted?
I was so exhausted, yeah. And the anti-aircraft was, firepower of anti-aircraft was really, really bad. Worse than the fighters.
And I want to hear about that. This is with the 487th Bomb Group flying out of England. And your early missions were in B-24s?
11 missions in B-24s, and then we switched over to B-17s.
Tell me about that first mission, because you've never done this before. You're a young guy. What was that like?
Oh, okay. The first mission, we went to a big power plant just barely into Germany, and we were very confused. As a matter of fact, it was 400 and some guys in 39 airplanes, and there was only one that had ever been across the English Channel, and he was Colonel Bernie Lay, who wrote 12 O'Clock High and some other books. He was our commanding officer. Mm-hmm. He's the only guy that had ever been across the English Channel, mind you.
How about that?
So anyway, we got confused, and I know when we were on the bomb run, we looked, and here was a squadron of B-17s or B-24s, I forget, with their bomb bay doors open, come right over the top of us, about 200 feet over the top of us, with their bomb bay doors open. And anyway, we bombed. And then we, because they all drop on the lead plane of 13 airplanes. We got back for a briefing, and Colonel Bernie Lee called, and he said, I want that wise young lieutenant to come up here and tell me, show me what he hit. And I said, you know, I'm not sure we hit anything. Well, he said, you're wrong. You hit the power plant right on the button. And we had some pointers and one thing and another. So anyway, they promoted me to the lead airplane after that.
Because you had hit the target?
Yeah, and our bomb group of the 487, there was about 60 groups. Our group has been said to be the most accurate group in the 8th Air Force, and there's four squadrons in a group, and our squadron, the 839th, was supposed to be the very best, and I was the lead bombardier, so I think I'd done a good job.
Over the years on this program, we've heard from a lot of people who were involved in D-Day in one way or another, whether they're paratroopers, glider pilots, guys hitting the beach. It was such a massive operation. But I've also been struck by folks like you who were flying missions that day, and you had a very interesting perspective on what was going on. Did you guys have any idea of how massive this situation was going to be?
No, absolutely not. It was just totally unbelievable. Early, and we had to fly down where the ships were leaving from Southampton and down in there. And we had to follow a line of ships about 80 miles across the channel. And then we went inland about 25 miles to bomb a town of Lisieux. It was German headquarters, railroad yards, and so forth. And then we had to come back, and we had to follow some ships that were just emptying, and they were heading back to Southampton. We had to follow them, or otherwise they claimed they would shoot us down. But, you know, there was 5,000 ships involved in that. That's big ones.
Well, that's what very few people have ever seen with their own eyes what you saw that day.
Yeah, that's true.
What did that look like, looking down on that channel?
Unbelievable. It looked like there was 1,000 water beetles hitting the beach, because we were there just when they were hitting the beach. And inland a little ways was where all the gliders were.
Mm-hmm.
And it looked like most of them had crashed. There were a clutter of them in the middle of some big fields, and then they singled out here and there. But looked like about every one we saw was busted up. Mm-hmm. So they must have had a rough time. But the paratroopers dropped a few hours before that. Of course, we didn't see them. We did not see the gliders until they were already on the ground.
Right. So you went across. You see all this. You drop your bomb load. You go back to England. Did you fly a second mission that day, or just the one round trip?
No, we were scheduled to, but we didn't. It started a pretty decent day, and before the day was over, you know, they flew 11,000 sorties on that one day. It pretty well fogged up, and everybody was flying, but there was so damn many airplanes that we just didn't get into the schedule of another. We went the next day. The second day, we arrived over there, and here was a bunch of ships sunk down there. And what they were they were old ships they'd brought towed over there. I knew they tied three together in two places and two in another and sunk them and let gaps in between.
Mm-hmm.
And already the little boats were going through the gap to break the sea.
Right.
Because it was a bit rough that day.
Yeah, some of those are still over there. They're still visible there, as you know, because you've been back a few times and are going back again here shortly. That day has been talked about so much, the longest day. So many different accounts of what happened that day, and we know now with the lens of history what a difference it made in the bigger picture. But for you at the time, do you remember what you made of it, what you made of what you saw, and maybe was there some uncertainty as to whether this was going to be a success or not?
Well, yeah, everybody wondered that, and they paid the price. Not that day the Air Force didn't. They didn't have time to be shooting at us, and it was one of the very few days that we didn't get anti-aircraft. And, of course, we didn't see any fighters at all on that day in around there. But the Germans were shooting on the water all the time. You could see shells splashing out in there, and I know Cherbourg on one end, and they were both burning and shells hitting in there. But a beachhead is always a costly thing.
No doubt.
Yeah.
Very costly that day.
Yeah, because you're short end of the stick. You're sitting out there in the water or on the beach, and everybody else is up there in a cave someplace, shooting at you.
Mm-hmm. And I want to move on to the rest of your missions and hear some of those stories. But you have gone back to some of the commemorations of D-Day, even this past one, the 72nd anniversary. Why do you do that? Why is that a significant thing in your life?
It was one of the biggest things in my life that happened. And I'm proud of it. Of course, nowadays, there's not many of us left. Three trips we made, I haven't seen anybody in their original uniform. Like, I still wear the same one. I wear it in the parades here. And
you were wearing it that day, on June 6th, 1944?
No, you don't wear your uniform when you're flying.
Oh, of course. You're wearing your flight jacket.
Flight suits and stuff, yeah.
But it was from that time period.
Yeah, it was. Four of us had them made in London. A lot of them did, but it was a group of four of us ordered them in London in 1944. And every time we come back, we'd have another medal to have them sew on the jacket. You can see me wearing it. I'm wearing it in all these pictures.
Well, I bet you get quite the reception when you walk around
with
nowadays,
that uniform. There's nobody else. Yeah, I just got back from the Back to the 40s dance we go to every year down in the Modesto Airport.
Mm-hmm.
They honor veterans, main thing, and everything that happened in the 40s. And, of course, I'm the only one wearing a uniform.
As far as wearing that uniform in France, when you go back to Normandy for the D-Day anniversaries, is there something that someone has said to you or shared with you that met you there that's meant a lot to you?
Yeah, quite a few people, but they're extremely nice. The French in Paris, that's a different story. But out in the country, they hug you. In 5 minutes, I'll have a gathering of 200 people around me, signing autographs, taking pictures, and stuff like that. So it's quite a turn-on.
Has that changed your perspective on what you did and its importance?
No, I just figured it was all important because the people that we helped out are the people that are on our side. Yeah, except the Germans there. We've been in Germany quite a few times, too.
Mm-hmm.
And they were extremely friendly. But the French in the country really surprise you. And there's older French ladies that, now this was 72 years ago when you met, and they're 85, 90, and they're all hugging you. Mm-hmm. They were little young ladies at that time.
And they remember.
Yeah.
They remember what it was like to not be free.
And yeah.
You guys secured their freedom. So these bombing missions, you mentioned the anti-aircraft fire. Was this on just about every mission?
Every mission except D-Day.
Wow.
As near as I can remember. And we actually had holes in the airplane all but three or four missions, as near as I can remember. Some we didn't know we had until we got back. And one of the first trucks that would pull up would be the patch crew. They'd have a small van, and at that time we had olive drab airplanes, and they put silver patches on them. Got looked like a patchwork quilt before long. But my last mission was the worst. It was a brand new airplane. We had gone to in the Leipzig area. Anyway, we had so many holes in it. We had over 200 holes in the upright stabilizer alone, and we had in the fuselage, round fuselage, we had shells that came through and went out on the rounded sides and made two big holes. The radio man, it went right through the fuselage there, and he was out of it. He wasn't hurt. He was just sitting there. Then we had a complete 88 shell went about 2 feet from me, went right straight out through the airplane without exploding.
Wow.
Because they had a lot of people left. They had a lot of slaves, they might say, that were putting these bombs together, and a lot of them were fixing them so they wouldn't go off. And we lucked out and have one, but it went right in and went right straight out the top.
Right, so you're talking about the Germans had these slave labor camps, and the prisoners are putting together these shells, and at the risk of their own lives, because if they were caught, they'd be killed on the spot, but they sabotaged some of them, and in doing so apparently saved your life.
Yep, it could very well be.
And you said 2 feet from you?
Yeah, just about 2 or 3 feet, because I leaned around and I could see it and looked big enough to jump out of.
And your plane's still flying?
It was still flying, yeah, and a lot more than that. I got hit in the arm. It bounced up and down on the 50 caliber machine gun ammunition, and I had 13 pieces in there. That was on the bomb run, going to the target.
So you haven't gotten to the target yet. You haven't dropped your payload.
No, we were about 20 miles from the target. We were on what they call the IP going in.
What did that feel like when it hit you?
Well, yeah, it didn't hardly hurt. It just bounced up and down, but it got hurt and beat hell on the way back home. But we got the bombs away, and the same as the one in my face here, it knocked me clear off of the seat and down into the floor of the front of the nose of the airplane, and I got back up, and got back. I was on the bomb run then, about 20 yeah. miles from.
And I want to keep them separate so I don't confuse
okay.
the two.
Yeah.
And I'll go back and ask you about that one. But so sticking with this last one. So you've described some of the damage to your airplane. You've got stuff coming through all over the place.
Yeah, there was a lot more than that. Out in the wings, you could see where the shells had gone through out there.
And are you seeing the flak in front of you as you fly through it?
Oh, yeah.
And you've got no choice.
It would be just about cut the sun off.
That dark.
That much, yeah.
Anybody volunteering for this duty? We need to take a break, but we'll get back into the nose of that B-17 with Denny Thompson when we come back. For photos, videos, and other links relating to his story, visit hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country, and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and today's visit with 94-year-old Denny Thompson of Sonora, California. Born in Fargo, North Dakota, he grew up in Staples, Minnesota, hunting and trapping mink and other furs. But when we left off, he was a 21-year-old. He was flying his 30th and final mission as a bombardier with the 839th Squadron of the 487th Bomb Group. It was November 5th, 1944, and Denny was in the nose of a B-17 flying over Germany.
This target was Ludwigshafen. We bombed the IG Farben chemical works, a huge chemical works. And it turned out that Fritz Karl Flick, the German billionaire, was the owner of that and Mercedes. He owned Mercedes and 260-some corporations. I took them hunting 4 times in Alaska.
Uh-huh.
They'd fly their private, big, huge jet to Anchorage. Then they'd charter a twin to bring him out to my lodge, and Fritz wouldn't fly with anybody but me.
Even though you were one of the guys who bombed his place, huh?
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
Forgiveness is a powerful thing.
He was the richest man in the world then, and the only other billionaire was Jay Mellon of the Mellon family, Mellon Banks.
So you're on this bomb run, and that's your target, but your plane's been shot up all over the place. You've been wounded once before, and now your arm is torn up with all this shrapnel, but you still have to finish the mission.
Yep, and did.
Did that take some...
I was recommended for the Silver Star. It's in the book there. But we got a telex back from headquarters from I'll never forget, a General Partridge. He says, hey, we got to run on Silver Stars. Give the lieutenant another Distinguished Flying Cross. Mm-hmm. That's how I got 2 of them.
Uh-huh. Was that difficult to do, to finish that mission with your arm in that kind of shape?
I didn't think so.
But after you release the bombs, you still have to get
Jesus,
back to your base.
Yeah, when my arm did hurt. It was swelled up, and we put powder and stuff, you know. Anyway, when we got back, we had to shoot a red flare off that you had wounded aboard, and you could go come right in. Of course, we only had 2 engines left and 1 flat tire. We ran off the runway and got stuck in the mud with the whole thing. It was a brand-new airplane when we left.
Mm-hmm.
It was a piece of junk when we got back. Well, anyway, they come up and got me. There was another guy wounded in there. And the flight surgeon, flight surgeon came up and he says, Denny, he says, I think you're finished. Here's a jug of whiskey. I was 21 years old. Anyway, I was pretty well snockered before I got to the base hospital. Again, 3 weeks later, it was about 10 miles away And we had just received brand new electric flying suits. They looked like a tuxedo.
Uh-huh.
And being conservative from Minnesota, I wouldn't let them cut the sleeve off. And it was swelled up like a balloon. Well, eventually they pulled it off. I know the flight surgeon said, "You're done." Well, anyway, that evening my whole group came over. I was about one of the last ones, if not the last one, to finish of the original group that flew our airplanes overseas.
Uh-huh.
About 10 days later, that's about the time they let me out of there, there was this big Battle of the Bulge going on. And the guys that were in my big room in the hospital, most of them were second lieutenants and stuff with bad wounds, and they said they're freezing their butt off over there because they didn't have winter gear. So we had just got issued electric flying suits, and all the sheepskin ones were piled in the warehouse, so I went over and commandeered two big truckloads of them.
So you're talking about the electric flight suits, and maybe some people don't understand how that would work. The idea is when you guys are flying at this altitude in a non-insulated, non-pressurized cabin, it's crazy cold up there.
60 below zero.
Yeah.
Many times.
So before you had the electric flight suits,
sheepskin, but you couldn't hardly move.
Uh-huh.
Move around in the darn things.
So this was such a luxury to you, you didn't want them to cut it off of you and ruin it when you got wounded.
Right.
And then when you saw these guys who'd been wounded at the Battle of the Bulge and you heard about their frozen extremities and all that, you decided to liberate some flight suits and send them back that way?
And bunny boots. They were sheepskin as well.
Uh-huh.
And they loved them. They were crazy about it, all the stuff. We brought them back to the hospital, and as the guys were getting released to go back over there again, they picked out what they wanted, and that was it.
Did you have to get permission to do that?
I don't recall getting any permission. I went and talked to the supply sergeant, and
uh-huh.
He said, "Hell yeah, they're just laying around."
And how bad were the wounds on your arm?
Not bad. It just hurt. They hurt really bad when I first came. Other than that, it didn't seem to shatter any bones. Just a lot of small pieces in there.
And you still have one in there?
Yeah. It was swollen up, and I think they took a dozen out.
Uh-huh.
But they happened to miss that one. Since then, every time I see a doctor, especially a long time ago, "Oh, we better take that out." I says, "No, it didn't bother me, and my kids like to feel it. You know, it's there." So it hasn't bothered at all. It's a wonder it wouldn't rust or something.
Yeah.
But it doesn't bother a bit.
Well, it's part of you now. You don't want to take it out.
No, I'll never take it out, no.
I bet it makes quite the conversation piece when you travel and wear that uniform.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah, it does. I don't know how many people have felt that sharp thing in there. Yeah. Oh, that showed you? Yeah.
I'll hop in line.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the story of your final mission. And you knew that was going to be your final mission. 30 was the number of missions you had to fulfill in order to come home. Were there moments during that mission where you thought, "Hey, I might not make it home"?
Oh, many, many times, for sure. Because this time we only had two engines come back.
Only two.
We threw everything overboard, all the machine guns, and we were in the process of chopping the ball turret out because it's quite heavy.
Yeah.
When things were going along pretty good and going across the channel, but we got rid of a lot of weight.
Something tells me you probably hold that pilot in pretty high esteem.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's long gone now. I visited him when he passed away in Kansas.
Uh-huh.
30 years ago now. Oh, when I finished my mission and came back to the base, then you got your stuff together and went to get a ride on a boat or something.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we flew our own airplanes over through South America and Africa and so forth. So anyway, Colonel Bernie Lay, who wrote 12 O'Clock High, was our commanding officer. He'd got shot down alongside of us early in the game, and he was back. Anyway, he said, "If you'll stay to be the squadron bombardier, we'll make you a captain." And I said, "Do I have to fly any missions?" Well, he said, "Yeah, once in a while, make it look good for the boys." And I says, "You."
You'll pass,
no,
huh?
No, I'll take a pass. I stayed a first lieutenant the rest of the time.
Uh-huh.
But I got, it was 1 month to the day that I got wounded, where I was up in Northern Ireland waiting for an airplane to go to Newfoundland and to the States.
Right.
And we were having a crap game, and a bunch of us in it, and somebody ran over and said, "If anybody here has got two Purple Hearts, they can go right now on a C-54. And I said, hell, I got two Purple Hearts. And I threw the dice in, grabbed my money, and grabbed my bag and got on a C-54. And we flew to Newfoundland. And then we buzzed the Statue of Liberty and came into Washington, D.C. They had a brass band. It happened that there was a lot of fighter pilots and stuff that were wounded were on this airplane.
Mm-hmm.
It was about 30 of us on there. And all of us in our uniforms. And, oh, my God, we were treated like heroes. So then I went from there to pilot training in Texas.
What about when you got to see your family again? What was that like?
It was great. There's no doubt about it. Because I was the first one back of my brothers.
And earlier in the day you got back was when they got the telegrams that told them.
That's exactly right. The very same day. But by that time, they knew I was on a train coming to Minneapolis.
Have you ever thought about that? What it must have been like for your mother to know that three of her sons were over there in harm's way?
Oh, God, there was a lot of people in the same thing. Actually, a little later, my youngest brother went in the military.
Yeah.
But he happened to be a basketball player, so they hadn't played basketball all the time on the military team.
That's
but
my kind
he
of
was,
duty.
He was too young, too young for the WW2 anyway.
Right.
And, well, there were some others going on, the Korean and so forth, but they kept him playing basketball.
So you told us about getting wounded on the last mission, but you were wounded on your 27th mission.
And the 30th.
Tell me about that 27th mission. Where were you guys going and what happened?
We were going to Cologne, Germany, in the Ruhr Valley, of all things, a big truck factory. But if I remember right, it was a Chevy or a Dodge originally, a huge truck factory. Well, anyway, came through the plexiglass, hit me in the face, knocked me off. Anyway, we were just...
Hold on a second. That's kind of a big deal. That's not a no big deal.
Yeah,
Let me just pass it off.
It was a pretty big deal. But
you're flying along.
Just like somebody hit me and knocked me clear off of the seat, and I was on the bomb site getting it lined up on the target.
So
about
you're not looking out the plexiglass in front of you. You're not looking out the nose. You're staring down through a bomb site.
Right. Most of the time through the bomb site, and once in a while you look around. But
And it hit you and knocked you off the bomb site.
Yeah.
Where did it hit you?
Well, it hit me right here, and there's a little chunk of my cheek gone, and it ended up inside my mouth.
So the left side of your face got plastered by shrapnel.
Blood like a stuck hog. I had blood all over. There's a big instrument panel with switches and stuff, and I had blood all over that. I had everywhere. I remember turning around and looking at the flight engineer and the navigator. They were curled up on some flak suits right on the floor, because most flak, 9/10 of the flak, goes up. And their eyes got big like that. When I had silk gloves on, but I took my big gloves off, and I had blood all over them. And I kind of flicked them across their face, and their eyes got big. And anyway, we got the target, and we hit it dead center.
How'd you do that? If you're probably blinded in that left eye, aren't you?
No, it hit the cheek here.
Yeah,
but
you're swelling up, I'm sure.
There's a little. Well, it wasn't very long. It was about 20 miles, you might say. 5 minutes or something.
Weren't you in pain?
Not then. No, actually.
Half your face is blown up.
It just went. It was a long piece, and it went in straight. And that one didn't hurt funny at all. I find this is not too bad at all. I got a Purple Heart here, and that was the first Purple Heart.
So it was no big deal. This thing flying through your cheek and into your mouth, but it put you in the hospital for 10 days.
Yep, and then I was back flying again. And flew my last three missions, and the last one is when I got hit in the arm.
Uh-huh. And I bet, those two situations where you actually got hit are outnumbered by close calls where you almost got hit.
I don't know why more people didn't get hit. The airplanes had so many holes in them. Not one or two, but hundreds.
Mm-hmm.
The last mission, of course, was the worst one. That one had hundreds and hundreds of holes in it.
And I'm sure you also, from the vantage point you had, which is probably as good of a vantage point as anybody to see what's going on around you, you saw other planes that got blown up in midair?
We saw lots of them.
Or shot down and crippled to the point they had to bail out or crash land?
Lots of people bailed out, yeah.
You're seeing this almost every mission.
Yeah, exactly, because there were missions when 70 four-engine bombers got shot down.
Yeah.
Some with fighters, and we had fighters not a lot of times, but I remember one just about hit the nose of our airplane, come sailing down past us. And we were all firing machine guns. We had 13.50 caliber machine guns on there.
Mm-hmm.
They were thinned out a bit, but the anti-aircraft had picked up during 1944 because it was a lot cheaper for them to use a lot of anti-aircraft because they shot down a lot of airplanes with anti-aircraft.
And you had in formation flying, you have no choice but to fly right through
That's right. Earlier a year or two before us, they'd try a little evasive action, but you couldn't do it if you're going to pinpoint bomb. So all the airplanes had to stay in position, couldn't move. And then occasionally we would find a single B-24 or B-17 that had been captured by the Germans flying over there about a mile or two away and calling the shots. And we found out, we didn't know for sure it was them, but later on, you read about it almost every day if you read about military stuff.
Pretty eerie to consider. Well, I'm just wondering, Denny, what that says about you and the fact that you survived all this. If for 30 missions you're seeing planes to your right and to your left get shot out of the sky, sometimes explode. You know guys are dying around you. You know guys are getting wounded. You yourself are wounded twice. You see giant holes in your airplane. Yet you make it through all that. How is that possible? Why did that happen?
I think things were a little different then. We just figured that's the way it was, and where everybody was patriotic. The mission dragged on and on and on when you get only one at a time, you know. And then in between, as a lead crew, we had to leave to go for some more training in northern England. Like, we went and took the belly turret off and put a radar dome in there. And that took us a week or two to do that. That's why it took me about 8 months to fly all my missions. What we call the wing crew, sometimes in 3.5 or 4 months, they were through or shot down, whichever.
What was your motivation? What were you over there for?
I guess just patriotism. I don't know what else it would be, but it was everybody was very patriotic in those days.
Well, and it may not be as universal, but that patriotism isn't extinct either. I was reminded of that this past week, welcoming home another 68 veterans from an honor flight to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. You've heard me mention that a time or two on this program, and if you know a World War II veteran who hasn't been to the National Memorial in our nation's capital, I encourage you to go to honorflight.org. That's honorflight.org, and find that local hub nearest you. It's absolutely free for the veteran. Denny's been on one of those. He's also been back several times to Normandy and also to England, always donning his World War II uniform. Go to hometownheroesradio.com if you want to see what Denny Thompson looked like then and what he looks like now. And when we come back, we're going to hear about a few of the adventures he's had since World War II. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EEC. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting rvcountry.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, making our final approach now with a guy who has thousands and thousands of hours as a pilot in some of the more dangerous places to fly. But before becoming a pilot, he was a bombardier in World War II, surviving 30 missions in B-24s and B-17s over Europe with the 487th Bomb Group. And I think we've learned surviving is definitely the appropriate word there. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com, I have a link to his book with Neil Burkhart. It's called The Legend of Lieutenant Thompson. And if you read it, you'll learn about some of his many talents.
You know, a lot of guys who served on bomber crews have reminisced about some of the nose art on some of the plane, some more colorful than others. I don't know that I've ever talked to someone who was painting some of that nose art, though. That was one of your hidden talents?
Yep. I painted four different airplanes. And somewhere I've got a picture of me painting, and it says, the nose art artist, Denny Thompson. The first one was the Dragon Lady. Milton Caniff was a good friend of a young bombardier that was in our squadron, and he personally sent this big picture of the Dragon Lady, and I blew the picture up to about 10 feet long, and I'd chalk it in on the airplane. Then I'd paint what I could. We'd go on a mission, and generally you're in the rain somewhere, and it'd wash the chalk off. I'd have to keep painting that. Eventually I got it all painted, and I have pictures of it here somewhere in my junk.
What would you say was the most challenging aspect of being a bombardier for 30 missions over Europe?
Surviving, I would imagine. Yeah, because that was the ultimate. But you could very well see that you might not survive.
Uh-huh.
A lot of guys are taken prisoner, too.
Oh, yeah. I've talked to a lot of those guys.
Occasionally an airplane will blow up and nobody get out of it.
But you did survive. And it's a good thing, because if you didn't, none of your kids or grandkids would ever have been born.
Yep.
All these celebrities and tycoons wouldn't have had anyone to lead them around Alaska looking for big game.
Yeah. And I'm getting more popular as I get older, because there aren't anybody left. That's the whole thing. Number one, I don't know a soul that could possibly wear their uniform.
I've met a couple guys that can still squeeze into them.
That recently?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But that's an impressive feat, no doubt.
Yeah. Number one is they generally don't have them. Uh-huh. Number two, they're generally too fat to wear them.
Do you have a favorite story of all your hunting expeditions or one particular exploit that gives you the most satisfaction?
I remember one exploit was when I had Fritz Carl Flick, which is the richest man in the world, and he just...
The guy you had bombed his property in Germany.
Bombed his property. Yeah. And probably quite a few of his properties. Anyway, he had just shot a Kodiak bear.
Uh-huh.
And it was a springtime, and the ice on the lakes was kind of rotten, and we landed with skis. And I was taking off with him, and we couldn't get airborne because it was mushy snow, because I had a big bear hide in the back, and I had Fritz behind me. Well, eventually, we just couldn't go anymore. When we stopped, one ski went through the ice, and the other one stayed on the top, and then the wing stopped it out on this mushy ice out there. So I got out around the front of the airplane over the cowling, and I looked back, and Fritz is sitting back there. I said, Fritz, you ain't worth a bit more than I am right now. Get out of there. So he jumped out of there, and we were able to tread across the rotten ice and get over to shore, and I let him go ahead. I went back, got a hold of the bear hide, and dragged it out of there and dragged it across the ice. Then we switched airplanes because his private plane was waiting in Anchorage, and he wanted to go to Austria bird hunting. So we changed airplanes, and eventually the same day I got him back to Anchorage, and his crew was all waiting, and away they went. That was it. But that probably was one of the most interesting, but there was so many of them.
What are some of the names, some of the folks whose names we would recognize that you led on those hunting expeditions?
Carroll Shelby, hunted him, and Bob Peterson Publishing Company, the mayor of Vienna, and I flew the president of France, Gustave Destang, in Africa. Jay Mellon, he was a billionaire.
And I guess another question that comes to mind for me, if what I'm looking at here in your home is just a fraction of the big game that you've hunted down, there had to be one or two that were more challenging than the rest. Was there ever a quest that was so difficult that when you finally accomplished it, it felt extra special?
Well, I was charged by a lot of polar bear. About 50% of them would charge, whether hit or not, because they had no enemies out on the ice. And I shot a lot of them, along with the hunter, that dropped right at our feet. And actually had snow spraying on us. And one got a hold of my pants leg one time. But I guided for about 350 polar bear and around 1,000 Kodiaks and grizzly bears.
Oof.
They weren't near as mean as the polar bears were. But we still had a few close ones from them.
What's more terrifying, bracing for the impact of flak you know you're about to fly through, or waiting to see if that bear stops before it gets to you?
I think the flak was, because you never knew where it came from. We made a movie of a bow hunter, a famous bow hunter, Art LaHaye. Anyway, we landed on this one big bear, and it was 44 below. We just called a radio station 100 miles in. It was a government station. They said it was 44 below, and it was blowing about 25 or 30 knots, and so it was cold. Well, we landed and put a cover on the engine and got all lined up to take movies, 16-millimeter movies and this kind of stuff out on the ice. We were 100 miles out on the Chukchi Sea. It was early when there was nobody else flying in the whole country. We were all by ourselves out there. Well, this bear was a big one. It was a good 11-footer. We put this Art LaHaye out about 30 feet in front of us with his bow and arrow. We wanted to shoot with an arrow. A native was with me. I had a shotgun, and I had my .375. And we were down behind the ice cakes, looking out at where the bear is supposed to be. And I was trying to crank the lens on the camera so it zone in right or something. And we heard this Art LaHaye holler, "Here he comes, boys." And, well, we couldn't see or hear the twang of the bow, but apparently almost run over Art. He let go of the arrow when he was right alongside of him. And that bear stopped. It was snow coming in my face, and I was behind an ice cake about this high, on my knees, and that bear stopped right on the top of that ice right there. And I looked up about where that light bulb is, and here his head's about that big round, and he had his head cocked like that. Arrow was sticking out of the left-hand side, and there was blood coming down onto his paw, and he was looking right down at me. He was standing on the end of my .375. I kicked back, grabbed the .375, and kicked back, and was just turning it around to shoot him when this native alongside of me shot one shot with a 12-gauge shotgun with buckshot and blew one of his ears off. I forget which one. And that bear, instead of eating us, he stepped down off there. He stepped on top of that 16-millimeter camera. It was between my knees by that time, and my legs were stretched out. Drove it down into that hard snow and stepped across this leg. And about from here to one of those posts, I turned around and was going to shoot him from the rear end with that .375, and Art had come alive out there and was screaming, "Don't shoot them, boys. I want them to qualify for the Pope and Young Club," which is the record book for bows and arrows. So we didn't shoot him. We let him run off, but the wind was blowing. You can imagine 44 below and wind blowing 25, 30 knots is 30 miles an hour or more. Mm-hmm. And so we took out after him, and we never did catch sight of him. And these tracks got blown over, and it was late in the day. It was early in the spring, so daylight wasn't very long. So we flew 100 miles back to shore and stayed with the natives back there. And the next morning, we flew back out, timed ourselves, and I'd be damned if we didn't come right onto that bear with the big bloody shoulder and everything. And anyway, we landed. He fired a couple of arrows. You can imagine that wind blowing like that. No effect, so I give him my .375, so he finally killed the bear. And that bear was made into a rug, and we showed movies to the Green Bay Packers and a lot of different people over the years.
Well, you've had quite a few adventures, sir, and you're looking forward to some more.
Nothing too exciting.
Why? What do you get out of going back to Normandy or going to England, as you're going to do soon, and putting on that uniform from World War II with all your decorations on it? What do you get out of all that?
I think the attention of the people. I think it's probably, and then just kind of just look the sky over in the shoreline, see that I remember it. But I think it's the attention of the people.
They are so nice.
I mean, it's unbelievable.
Do you feel like you're representing your fellow veterans when you do that?
Yeah, I sure do.
And I guess that's the only other question I have is, what should we know? Those of us who weren't alive during World War II, who didn't live through that, what should we know about the men that you served with?
Well, they were patriotic. Everybody that I knew just rushed to sign up. Of course, it was a lot of them went to Canada, but I didn't know any of them. Everybody I knew was right. Even my brothers went in before Pearl Harbor, and so we knew something was coming. I think it's the last good war and the last real patriotic war. I think the soldiers since then in all these wars we've had have been patriotic, but they haven't really won any of them. They've just been standing them off. You know, they got so many restrictions that they can't shoot one guy or not unless he does something. It's almost like the police nowadays.
What would you say you're most proud of and most thankful for?
I think my military service, yeah. No doubt about that. Because I never failed anybody, and I've kept busy ever since.
A lot of the 90-plus-year-olds that I interview still drive, but you do a little more than drive. You chop wood?
Oh, yeah, I drop trees.
Uh-huh.
Just drop one yesterday morning, the one you drove between there, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And I give stove wood to about four or five other old people. One's a Vietnam vet, and there's a couple old ladies up the hill. Give them wood.
So you chop down your trees and provide firewood for your neighbors?
Yeah. I don't chop down live trees. But these dead ones, it's a good thing to get them down because the beetles will go from one to the other. That's why you see so many clumps of these dead trees.
Yeah.
And as soon as I see a big dead one, I drop it. I got one to go out here. I just like to, I enjoy doing it.
Do you know any other 94-year-olds who do that?
Nope. Ones I know are burning my wood. Yeah. Yeah.
What's the secret to staying so young and vibrant when your birth certificate
just
says?
Just keeping busy, I guess.
Yeah.
Being a Norwegian and Swede, started out with good health, and I've never had a heart murmur. I did have both knees replaced. I climbed so many mountains, carried so many doll sheep and bear hides and stuff on, I just ruined my... Mm. And this was 12, 14 years ago, and they've been perfect.
Hey, hey. For a guy who has experienced so many things, things that a lot of other people would pay big money to have a chance to experience themselves, is there something you haven't done yet that you're still waiting on, still looking forward
to? No, there sure ain't. Happy the way I am.
I heard you got to go on an honor flight.
Yeah, and that was great. And they kept us there 3 days.
Yeah.
It wasn't some of these, they go one day and they're back the same day.
Yeah, east of the Mississippi, that's what they do.
And this... old guy and his wife come up to me and they said, are you the bus driver? We're supposed to be on the bus. I had my uniform and all these medals on and everything. I laughed at that.
That
was kind of funny.
What was the highlight of that experience for you?
I'd say probably the highlight is when we come in the middle of the night to San Francisco and there must have been 500 people there.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome. I see it's still going on. A lot of people... bands and everything, greeting them when they come back.
Yep. You don't strike me as an overly sentimental guy, but standing there at the World War II Memorial and seeing that wall of gold stars, 406,000 Americans who died in World War II, did you have the thought I could have been part of one of those?
I'm sure I did. Didn't get carried away about it. I know that, but I just know I was luckier than hell.
I'd say so.
Yeah, you'd have to be. Yeah, you know the percentage of people lost in missions doesn't work out. It's only 100%. And if you lose 3% each mission, that eats it up.
Yeah.
And so you got to beat the odds somewhere or another.
You may not have known at the time, but now you know what was happening in those concentration camps all over. To know that that you and your fellow veterans had a hand in bringing that to a stop and saving so many lives, is that something that gives you satisfaction now?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I did. As a matter of fact, we went through, at Munich, we went to the Dachau, went through Dachau. And pretty sad thing, I'll tell you, the big crematories and stuff like that. And that was quite an experience. We went to Hitler's, what do you call that big the house on the top of the hill?
The Eagle's Nest?
Yeah, the Eagle's Nest.
Yeah.
And I put my uniform on, particularly to go to the Eagle's Nest. And so we went up by bus, and it about caused a riot when I put the uniform on down at the bottom. Yeah. Because there's a lot of Germans there, too.
Uh-huh.
They weren't mad. They were just excited.
I could see how that might be a little exciting. And if you'd like to see a 94-year-old Denny Thompson in his World War II uniform,
Maybe you want to order his book, written with Neil Burkhart, The Legend of Lieutenant Thompson. I have a link to it at hometownheroesradio.com. It's even available on Kindle. We're out of time today. Big thanks to Chase Anderson of Friends and Neighbors Magazine for connecting me to Denny. I have a link to Chase's article on this remarkable 94-year-old online for you as well. Next time, we're going to meet a 96-year-old survivor of the Battle of the Bulge who plays bocce ball every week in San Francisco and just can't wait to renew his driver's license when he turns 99. Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.